Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and at Bloomberg.com.
I want to bring in Katya Porzykanski. I mispronounced her name, even though we had just been talking about it. Katya Porzykanski, excuse me, Bloomberg News reporter, who wrote a fantastic story on the Bloomberg. It's one of the most well-read of the day, about bro culture on Wall Street and how Donald Trump rising to be the Republican candidate is actually empowering the bro culture. Can you talk a little bit about what your story was about?
Absolutely. I went into this thinking that I could write a story about the amazing discussions and dialogues that are happening across Wall Street trading floors that never happened before, with people, with men coming up to their female colleagues and being like, wow, let's really talk about this. But no, that's not really what's happening. I spoke with about 20 women at hedge funds, private equity firms, Wall Street banks, and that's really not what's going on, at least not in most of them. I've heard some really shocking stories, some stories I kind of expected. But
give us a shocking story.
One woman basically learned through all this that her boss doesn't really think that what Donald Trump was describing in his remarks about on the bus, those famous remarks, are that bad, basically. And she's a victim of sexual assault herself, and now she's wondering if she will be supported by her boss if something ever were to happen to her on a business trip or in the office environment. And she's also questioning his judgment,
her
boss's just general judgment if he's necessarily making good decisions.
So this sort of speaks to this point that former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer was making when he said that CEOs should not speak up in terms of who they support politically. But my question is Donald Trump such an other candidate here that when you're making comments like this that are so obviously degrading to women, is it your responsibility as a boss or a leader to make a public statement to show some sort of recognition I don't agree with these statements?
Well, exactly. I think that was what was really interesting from a lot of the conversations I had, that if you believe or your bosses or your colleagues are Trump supporters and they don't come out and just say, hey, by the way, I don't really agree with what he said about women, then you're on edge. Without having that conversation, you're going to be thinking to yourself, is that what my boss or my colleagues think about women? And the lack of a conversation is just as bad. So that's what was really interesting about it, because I mean, it's one thing when you're surrounded by women in an office and everyone kind of is talking about things all the time. But if you're that one woman on a trading floor and you're surrounded by 25 people who are backing a politician that feels this way about women, you need to have a dialogue.
Did you get the sense that people are actually emboldened to say even more aggressive statements with Donald Trump?
So there were a few women that I spoke with who sit on or by a trading floor that said that that the comments have added fuel to the joke pool,
For sure.
Yeah, and emboldened them to say things that on already a misogynistic day-to-day environment has gotten even worse. And the other thing that several women mentioned was it's not necessarily about Donald Trump; it's about Hillary Clinton too. A lot of the comments that are made about Hillary and her ability to lead that sound gendered are putting women, Republican Republicans and Democratic women alike on edge that, okay, is this what they think about leaders that are women, and therefore is this what they're thinking about me? And that was really powerful that several women mentioned that there's this constant, you know, that double bind of I can't be a leader and I can't be a woman. I can't make everybody happy. And it's bringing up all these thoughts, which in this inner dialogue, and they can't really talk about it to anybody because they don't want to be ostracized and they don't want to be thought of as emotional or overthinking
And speaking to that point, I mean, what has the response been like? Do people say that you're overthinking it?
Almost everybody that I spoke to said, I can't talk about this at work and I can't talk about it on the record. So... Or did they think that I was overthinking?
Well, no. That's very interesting. But after you wrote the article, I mean, what have the responses been like?
Oh, so I've gotten several emails from women being like, "This is spot on." Several emails.
So it's all been positive?
Not all of it. I have gotten a few emails, wondering, what my motives were, or if this is an opinion that I have. And I have to stress, this isn't an opinion. I went in thinking that this would be that all of Wall Street would have been enlightened or something about the struggles women face, and it wasn't that so. So there's an environment out there that I'm, not necessarily privy to, and I learned a lot from speaking with these women.
Are you surprised at all that we're still dealing with this level of sort of base comments? You know what I mean by that? In other words, that we haven't really been able to address as a professional culture yet, that talking about women in this way is obviously not cool.
Well, I think that the most overt stuff is kind of been taken care of, but the problem is that it's not gone. There's just this veneer, right? It's still there, but it's more subtle. It's not overt harassment, it's discrimination. That was the consistent theme. Every single woman I talked to said she still faces some sort of discrimination or sexism at work, and either at work or doing business in the field.
But maybe subtle, not necessarily
exactly.
So overt.
And that's what's even harder to address. It's not something you could just bring to HR and be like, this happened. It's more the constant things that just chip away at you and leave you behind.
Well, and I should say, I mean, Donald Trump is not necessarily representative of male leaders in corporate America. I remember a story a month or two ago about how any CEO who had said what Donald Trump had said would have been fired. There is a quote in an article from last month where a CEO of a boutique executive search firm said any CEO who got caught making the kind of comments Trump did would be out the door in 24 hours. So this isn't necessarily representative of
by any means. Exactly. And that was actually one of the points that one of the women I spoke to said. She said, if this guy would have been fired if he worked with us here, but he's there running for president, what kind of license is that giving the people around me to say something? So even if things aren't happening right now, if the effect isn't happening right now, it's bringing up questions in people's minds as to what will be the lasting impact from this, either for women because of the way that Hillary has been scrutinized in these circles, or for men to embolden them.
Katya Porzagansky from Bloomberg News, thank you so much. Fascinating story. And regardless of people's opinions, definitely a topic that's important just to talk about. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Lisa Abramowitz here with Alex Sherman. This is Bloomberg. I want to bring Heidi Scherholz into the conversation. She is the chief economist for Labor Secretary Tom Perez and a longtime labor economist who came to the Labor Department from the Economic Policy Institute. Heidi, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what was your big takeaway from today's jobs numbers?
I think the key thing about today's jobs numbers is that it shows that the labor market is continuing to reliably improve. We're seeing monthly job gains that are strong enough, they're solid enough to start tightening employment conditions. And the good thing about that is that that is in turn boosting wage growth. So the solid job growth is really starting to act on boosting wage growth now. So workers are seeing now sustainable, meaningful wage growth, and that's very good news for the American worker. We're not there yet. We still have progress. There's still progress to be made, but these are nice steps that we're taking.
And so, Heidi, we've seen the headline numbers, 161,000 jobs created last month for non-farm payrolls. The unemployment rate dropped to 4.9%. What is underneath the headline numbers that we should be paying attention to? Is there one or two sort of bullet points that stick out to you as particularly interesting or important for this month?
Yeah, one of the whenever I see a single number, I always want to check it against longer run trends because you know there can be month to month volatility in the numbers. We saw 161,000 jobs added this month. If you look over the last 3 months, it was 176,000. So what we saw today is in line with what we've been seeing. The key thing that I think is important. What that trend has been translating into that's not in those direct headline numbers is the wage growth. So over the last year, we saw 2.8% growth in average wages. Inflation over that period is running at about 1.5%. So that difference, right, that's what workers are taking home in terms of real or quote-unquote inflation-adjusted wage growth. And so that's good news. That's the thing that's not in the headline, but that is a really salient part of this report.
Well, but there were some blemishes in the report, in particular the participation rate. In other words, the share of working-age people who are employed or looking for work. It's just there are more people still who are working either part-time or have been out of work for so long that they're not even counted in these numbers. And that those rates of those people are still higher than it was before the last recession. I mean, how concerned are you about that?
That is part of the unfinished business of this recovery. In no way do we think that we are there yet, quote unquote. We are not, you know, sort of spiking the football. There's still a lot of work to be done. And labor force participation rate in particular is one of those areas. One thing about the specific movement that we saw this month, it ticked down, but it's sort of been bouncing around. It's actually been pretty flat. And to get a little bit wonky about that, that's actually weirdly kind of good news because there's demographic changes that should be pushing that labor force participation rate down. In particular, we're seeing this huge cohort of baby boomers hitting retirement age. So the fact that we're holding pretty steady while swimming upstream in terms of, you know, swimming against those demographic trends that would be pushing the labor force participation rate down, that actually means that we are seeing people being brought in who by the strengthening labor market.
Heidi, do you think that if the Fed does raise rates, which they're widely expected to do next month, and then continues on a pace that is perhaps two rate hikes next year, that the labor market will be able to continue making progress?
You know, I will let other people comment on the likelihood or results of any Fed action, but what we are seeing is an economy that's really resilient right now. We're just seeing steady, reliable job growth that has been pretty resilient to various headwinds that have been thrown in its direction.
One other question. With respect to wage growth, are there particular industries that have been driving the overall wage growth that we saw last month?
You know, I think one of the key features of the last couple years in the labor market is that we have seen strong growth, employment growth across the board, including in middle and high wage jobs. So we're really in the first part of the recovery, we really were seeing disproportionate growth in very low wage jobs.
Right.
In the last couple of years, that has shifted dramatically, and now we're seeing strong growth in middle and high wage jobs. And we saw that this month too.
Like what industries? What industries are you talking about in particular?
Professional and technical services. Mm-hmm. So that's the subsector of professional and business services. That's higher wage jobs, like computer systems people that come into a business and help with computer systems, accountants, architects, those kinds of professional and business services. We saw decent job growth in construction in October. Those are a relatively high-paying jobs. We're seeing strong growth in education and health. There's those sort of tend to be, for the most part, middle-wage jobs. And so it, again, the job growth is across the board, but we are definitely also seeing this growth in middle and high-wage jobs.
Heidi Shierholz, thank you so much for being with us. Heidi Shierholz, Chief Economist for Labor Secretary Tom Perez on today's Jobs Report. I'm Lisa Abramowitz. I'm here with Alex Sherman filling in for Pim Fox. This is Bloomberg. Will this be another Brexit? That's certainly what a lot of traders think right now. The U.S. election's coming up, and you have some market makers, some exchanges that are preparing and requiring more margin, people that post more margin in order to gird against potential volatility. Here to break it all down with us is Lanan Nguyen of Bloomberg News. You wrote a fabulous story about this. So how are people preparing for potential volatility in currency markets right now?
So what we've heard is that a lot of people are really preparing for the unexpected. As with Brexit, a lot of people were cut out, weren't prepared for the sort of political uncertainty that followed. So right now, no one on the street is taking anything for granted. They are staffing up, double staff, overnight pizza, coffee, all of that. But also in terms of the weeds, you know, people are stress testing all their portfolios. They're looking at where they're most vulnerable on the downside in case of something unexpected happening.
So you're talking not only about investors, but you're also talking about dealers and exchanges. Can you talk a little bit about what the potential risk is for them that they're trying to protect against?
Well, the markets have been very illiquid. And so a month ago, obviously, we saw the flash crash happen overnight in the pound. And that's gotten people kind of sitting up because foreign exchange markets in particular have been very illiquid. And so when something unexpected happens, when a headline comes out, markets can have this cascading effect in terms of prices. So that's something everyone is looking out for. There's also a question of, you know, big volumes going through overnight. You know, if a headline comes out, suddenly everything's moving all at once, and you could get algos tripping and causing big moves.
We're seeing an interesting disconnect, I think, between investors who, as your story points out, seem to be, you know, let's say panicking might be too strong, but certainly preparing themselves for a Donald Trump win. And CEOs...
Wait, hold on. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, Alex. I'll let you continue one second. But when you said, I don't want to get carried away with panicking, there is somebody quoted in your story, Lanan. I'm getting night sweats and flashbacks of Brexit. I mean, that person, that portfolio manager might be panicking.
Correct. And by the way, as an aside to making the point I'm going to make, I have been bothered by the Brexit comparison to this up until very recently, because the Brexit polls the day before or so were like 51-49. Mm. Until very recently... You know, the almost every, you know, let's say look at 538, which has been sort of the dominant website on this. You know, the polling has been nothing close to that. Now, recently, the polls have started to tighten a little bit, and then maybe the Brexit comparison is a fair one. But my original point is that CEOs seem to be nonplussed by the election. All you need to do is look at what M&A volume has been over the past month or so. The M&A in October was the highest M&A volume of all time ever. Just weeks before the election.
Well, that could be potentially because they wanted to take advantage of the low borrowing costs too, right? I mean, that's sure. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. And that may be a thing. But if the election was that big of an issue for them, if there was that much fear associated with it, that would likely, again, no pun intended, trump concerns about concerns about interest rates rising. I spoke to several people about this. People, advisors, lawyers who are in the boardroom, and they told me, honestly, the election doesn't even come up in CEO conversations.
Well, really?
So they're not concerned.
Maybe because they don't want to get into trouble. But Lanan, I wanted to ask you about which currencies in particular are most at risk. I mean, the Mexican peso seems like a pretty ripe candidate, as well as the U.S. dollar. What are people telling you?
It's going to be the U.S. dollar for sure, obviously. On the other side of that dollar trade, you have the yen, which is a safe haven currency. So obviously, if something unexpected happens, the yen could get a bid. Mexican peso has been super sensitive throughout this entire presidential election process. And the retail brokers have raised their margins on the peso because they want people to set aside more money in case something crazy happens.
Well, yeah, and hasn't Mexico been raising interest rates just in order to support the peso because of the bets that Trump could could become president and therefore would send the value of the peso down?
So this is something interesting. You know, we hear people in the markets talking about potentially intervention by the Mexican authorities in the currency. You know, obviously this is pure speculation, but people are starting to have those conversations in the street about what's going to happen in the Mexican peso come election night. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
So all-nighters. People are going to be staffed up over in Asia, too, I would imagine.
Yep. Asia, London, the U.S. I think this is a kind of all-hands-on-deck situation.
I think everybody's going to be staying up all night anyway to watch the exactly. results come out. Linan Nguyen, thank you so much for joining us. Linan Nguyen, who covers the FX markets very, very well for us here at Bloomberg News. Thank you to talk a little bit about how the volatility in the foreign exchange markets is already getting some people having night sweats and flashbacks of Brexit. This is Bloomberg. Well, now we're going to turn our sights to the retailers of the world and what they're expecting for this holiday season. Now that I guess that Halloween is over, we can start talking about Christmas. I've already seen the Christmas candy in the stores. Craig Johnson, president of Customer Growth Partners. Do you think that this is going to be as bad a holiday season as some retailers seem to be suggesting?
Well, we're pretty often contrarian, and we think it's actually going to be a little bit better. The consensus is it's going to be up about 3.5% year-over-year total sales. And we think it's going to be up 4.1%. We've been doing this for 16 years forecasting, and we think things are coming together in time for what's going to be a little bit better. It's not going to be a blowout Christmas. It's going to be a little bit better than people anticipate.
Well, what types of stuff in particular?
Well, the one thing that's new this year is that the health and beauty sector has been very strong. And that's not just CVS and Walgreens, but it's things like Ulta, beauty salons, GNC, Vitamin World, that whole health area, the whole beauty area, which is grouped together with the major drug stores, is going to be a big driver. That's going to be up 7.4%. So that's going to be the strongest merchandise sector. Online, e-commerce will still be the overall fastest growing sector. That'll grow up about 13.9% year over year. As a macro sector.
Well, certainly GoPro and Fitbit are going to need good holiday seasons after reporting their earnings this week, both of them disappointing. Do we expect consumer electronics to be big? Is there some sort of hot gadget this year that may drive some holiday sales?
Well, the wearable technologies, they will get some amount of sale, but they've been on the market for a little while. That's not net new. The one thing that is new and with not just the Oculus, but also the Sony, the VR, the virtual reality technology has been coming on very strong. And, of course, that operates in conjunction with video games. And video games themselves, the consoles, it's now been at least 3 years since any new generation of consoles. But now with the VR technology, that is driving a lot of interest. And it's a great giftable item. And it can really dramatically enlarge your experience, you know, whether you're in an Xbox environment or a Sony PS4 environment.
Are your kids old enough to be asking for that,
well,
Lisa?
They are older and beyond that. But no, but my son will do it, because, you know, a lot of kids, you know, people in their 20s will do it. So, but that is the nature of the VR technology appeals both to the classic teen gamers, but also there's a lot of ex-teen gamers that are now entered well into their 20s and 30s that love the thing.
Yeah, my 7-year-old actually literally yesterday said to me that some of his friends have iPhones and that he should have an iPhone, and that one of his friends has 2 iPads. And I said, well, that's very nice for him, but too bad, so sad.
Maybe he can give him one.
Exactly. I don't think that that's going to necessarily justify my giving him one. You know, hey, Craig, I was going to talk a little bit about the clothing shops that have struggled so much. You know, we're talking about J. Crew or, you know, some of the teen brands or Victoria's Secret. What about those?
Well, apparel is it's going to have an okay season, not at all great. On a unit demand, meaning unit volume, sales will be up about 4 or 5%, which is nice, strong growth. The problem is apparel, just like food and consumer electronics, there's a lot of price deflation in that. So that price deflation of about 3% and change is going to pull that unit volume down to only about 1.5% total sales growth. And some sectors of apparel are just getting crushed right now because of the warm weather, particularly outerwear sales. And so we see a lot of outerwear, the heavier jackets and parkas and so forth, on sale at 50% off. So that's people that are in that side of the business are getting crushed.
Do you believe the excuse that some out there have been saying that the elections have dampened purchases?
I'm not sure I really buy that. Retailers are notorious for using, any kind of excuse for lousy sales. Oh, it's the weather's too hot, it's too cold, or it's too medium, or it's the elections. Weather and now elections are the last refuge of retail scoundrels that are underperforming. Nonetheless, any kind of major purchases, some people might be holding off on that a little bit. We've seen auto sales drop back a little bit, but we've also seen at the same time big picture TV, the large TV sales, I mean the big guys, 65, 70 inches, those have been very, very strong. And if there's any kind of election impact, it's certainly not affecting that sector. But from a sales point of view, a dollar point of view, there's such price deflation in that. Things are down 15 to 20% a year on a per inch basis. The dollar numbers will not be as great as the unit volume growth.
With the monthly jobs report coming out today, we did get some interesting data on the amount of hours Americans are working. I believe this past month it was about 34.4 hours in a week. As you sort of talk about retail sales, that part of what's actually dampening growth for holiday spending is that Americans are not working consistently 40-hour-a-week jobs. If they were, just how much better would holiday spending and retail growth be?
Huge, because right now, barely 49% of working-age adults have a full-time job. And if people had the same, versus 55%, 10 or 12 years ago, that basically represents, in terms of a full-time job equivalent, about 14-15 million missing or phantom full-time jobs. On an hours basis, right now, if you went back to 15 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, American working age adults on average worked about 26 hours a week. Everybody, all in. Not just the people in labor, on all. Now only the average adult only works only 22 hours a week. So you can do the math about what that's going to do to your incomes, and that affects retail sales and everything else. So we need to ramp up the full-time growth, full-time job growth, and not just be looking, unemployment is 4.9%, which is kind of a phony artifact statistic. So we got to get the hours up and incomes. And that's what, at the end of the day, it's rise in overall disposable personal income that drives all consumer spending, and retail is the single biggest part, of course, of consumer spending.
Craig Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. Craig Johnson, president of Customer Growth Partners, which is based in New Canaan, Connecticut, talking about holiday sales at retailers and how his contrarian view is that they are going to do better, Alex, than a lot of people have been saying. I'm Lisa Abramowitz here with Alex Sherman. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm out there on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm out there on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Come
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.